Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from antiwar.com. This is anti-war news for Friday, April 19th, 2024. Alright, so the first story at the top of antiwar.com today, Israel launches an attack on Iran. So this story first broke. It was first reported by ABC News. They cited a U.S. official who said Israeli missiles hit Iran, which made it sound like it was a very big attack. But then it came out that Iranian media, they're reporting right now, as of right now, it's 12:30 a.m. Friday morning on the East Coast in the U.S. So details of this are still not clear. But Iranian media is reporting that three drones were intercepted in Isfahan, in the province of Isfahan. And that was the explosions that were reported, because initially it was actually explosions reported in Iran, and then the U.S. official saying that Israeli missiles hit Iran. Now they're saying the explosions, at least Iran is saying, the Iranian media, saying that the explosions were drones being destroyed by air defenses. Again, lots of details are unclear at this point. And there was other reports that say there was explosions in Syria and Iraq. Some reports said that there were airstrikes in Syria and there was aircraft activity reported, but that's all very unconfirmed at this point too. Initially, it did seem like some sort of very big attack was happening with explosions reported in Iran, Syria, Iraq, and all of that. So according to CNN, the U.S. knew that Israel was planning to hit Iran with the understanding that nuclear sites would not be targeted. Iranian media is reporting that nuclear sites in Isfahan are safe. So on Thursday, Iranian officials warned that if Israel targeted nuclear sites, Iran would launch tit-for-tat strikes on Israeli nuclear facilities. So, but it looks like Israel did not target Iranian nuclear facilities. But at the same time, while this does seem pretty limited right now, Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, has been warning of a major response to any type of Israeli attack. He basically said, if they launch the slightest attack on us, we're going to hit them much harder than we did. So there's still the risk of this, you know, thing really exploding. It's amazing. I was watching the ABC News coverage of this. No mention of Israel bombing Iran's consulate in Damascus. I mean, it was really unbelievable. They kept saying, oh, Israel had to respond to this unprecedented Iranian attack on their territory, which, of course, Israel started this escalation by bombing Iran's embassy, by bombing an Iranian diplomatic facility and killing seven Iranians. I believe they killed a total of 16 people, including seven members of the IRGC and a very senior Quds Force commander. And other important context is the fact that Israel has, you know, frequently targets Iranians in Syria, but this, of course, was a huge escalation. Other context, Israel has launched drone attacks inside Iran before, and these have been launched by whatever sort of Israeli assets they have in Iran, small, like quadcopter drones that they launch from inside Iran. It's not clear right now if these drones were launched from outside Iran or not. That stuff will become clear, you know, come morning. So again, hopefully this doesn't explode into anything. Again, I think this could be bigger. You know, maybe I'm kind of downplaying it now. This could be bigger than what these reports suggest at the time. And who knows exactly what happened in Syria and Iraq. They might have killed some Iranians there. We don't know. So there's a lot that'll come out. And President Biden told Netanyahu that the U.S. would not support an Israeli offensive attack on Iran. But of course, the U.S. said that it would continue to defend Israel. And, you know, military aid continues to flow. So that to me sounds like they're supporting whatever Israel is doing. Hopefully this doesn't escalate. I wish I had more details for you, because I'm putting this show out, you know, and there's going to be a lot more coming out in a few hours, I'm sure. I'm going to link to the Al Jazeera live updates that they're doing in here. And keep an eye on antiwar.com. It's going to be updated on Friday and throughout the weekend. So we'll definitely be posting stuff on this. All right, so to get into the next story here, Iran warns Israel not to target nuclear facilities. So this is getting into some of the things that an IRGC official said on Thursday before this Israeli attack. I just want to read some of the quotes because I think it's important. So, and again, Israel has a history of targeting Iran's nuclear facilities, civilian nuclear facilities. They're not making a bomb, and they've done these sabotage attacks. So this is IRGC General Ahmad Haqtalab. He said, quote, "If the Zionist regime decides to take action against our nuclear facilities and centers, it will definitely face our reaction. For a tit-for-tat retaliation, the regime's nuclear facilities will be attacked with advanced weapons," end quote. So he also signaled that Iran could reconsider its ban on developing nuclear weapons. He said, quote, "If the fake Zionist regime decides to use the threat of attacking our country's nuclear centers as a tool to put pressure on Iran, it is possible and conceivable to revise the nuclear doctrine and policies of the Islamic Republic of Iran and deviate from the previously declared considerations," end quote. Now, this is just an IRGC general. You see pretty hawkish rhetoric from the IRGC, you know, the upper level. Any sort of decision like that would have to be made, obviously, by Khamenei, the Ayatollah, and there's no indication that that's something that's going to happen anytime soon. But and it's important to point out, with the Iranian nuclear stuff, you constantly see the claims from Israel and the U.S. that they're trying to build a bomb. I put some more stuff in here. I know I covered this yesterday, but just about the fact that Iran has increased its nuclear enrichment over the past few years since the U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. Trump pulled out of it in 2018. Iran waited a year, hoping that it would be offset by European countries, you know, some of the sanctions. And then they started increasing uranium enrichment. And in a recent U.S. intelligence report, the threat assessment said that Iran is doing this to build negotiating leverage and that they're not trying to make a bomb. And that is the reality of the situation. But again, and then another thing, you know, Raisi did say, even the slightest attack, you know, we're going to hit Iran even harder. We're going to hit Israel even harder than, you know, the attack the other night. So there's definitely still chance here of a escalation, of a bigger escalation. All right. So the next one here, the U.S. announced new sanctions on Iran on Thursday, which are really just symbolic because Iran is already under so many sanctions that I don't think these will really have any impact. But the State Department said that the sanctions are targeting Iran's drone program and its steel and automobile industry over allegations that the companies are tied to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. These measures are largely symbolic since Iran is essentially under a U.S. economic blockade. Iran has found relief in recent years by selling more oil to Asia, to countries in Asia and East Asia. And recent U.S. sanctions have tried to target those sales, but they haven't really been able to do too much. So the U.K. also announced sanctions on Iran's military. They said they did it in coordination with the U.S. So these are the big sanctions that the U.S. rolled out, again, that aren't really going to do too much. But the U.S. has just, they got to do something, you know. They can't do nothing. All right, the next one here, two Hezbollah fighters, one civilian killed in Israeli strikes. This is from Jason Ditz. Israel carried out airstrikes against southern Lebanon on Thursday, hitting the village of Qaim and nearby Kfar Killa in a flurry of deadly attacks. Two Hezbollah fighters were reported slain in the attacks, and then one civilian was also killed, and three were wounded. So another thing that I saw when the news of this Israeli attack on Iran initially broke, there's all these reports of big drone attacks on northern Israel, but that turned out not to be a false alarm. This was a pretty significant Israeli strikes in Lebanon on Thursday. So this is always an area that could escalate as well. All right. So now you're going to listen to the second half of the show, which I recorded before this half because I was just going to, I was letting the news develop. So go enjoy that segment where I'm a little younger. All right, so the next one here, the U.S. vetoes Palestinian bid for full U.N. membership. So on Thursday, the U.S. vetoed a U.N. Security Council resolution that would have granted Palestine status as a full U.N. member, a move that goes against this claim from President Biden that he favors a two-state solution. So the U.S. was the only member of the 15-member council to vote against this resolution, while the U.K. and Switzerland abstained. So in the U.N. Security Council, a resolution needs 9 votes to pass, but the U.S. and the 4 other permanent members of the council, China, Russia, France, and the U.K., they have veto power. So that's what the U.S. did here. And we've seen the U.S. cover, you know, the U.S. has historically covered for Israel at the U.N. Security Council. We saw them veto, I think it was at least 3 resolutions calling for a ceasefire. They finally let one through that was very limited, you know, a temporary Ramadan ceasefire that was linked to some sort of hostage release. And as I covered yesterday, The Intercept reported, citing a leaked diplomatic cable, that the U.S. was lobbying other countries on the Security Council to vote against this because the U.S. didn't want to have to do a veto because the optics of it are very bad. And the Biden administration has come under criticism for claiming that it wants a two-state solution, that it wants to see a future peace deal with a two-state solution, while simultaneously providing unconditional military and diplomatic support for the Netanyahu government, which explicitly is opposed to a Palestinian state. Netanyahu has stated that he will not allow the creation of a Palestinian state in any future scenario. That's what he has said. And he has also credited himself with the fact that there is no, a Palestinian state has never existed. And this is not unique to Netanyahu. He put forward a resolution in the Knesset, rejecting the idea of a unilateral creation of a Palestinian state, and that passed in a vote of 99 members of the Knesset out of 120 supported that. So again, it's not unique to Netanyahu and his government, this opposition to a Palestinian state. All right, so the next one here, the U.S. and Israel have shared objective in Rafah. So the White House said in a statement on Thursday that the U.S. and Israel have a shared objective to see Hamas defeated in Rafah, which is the southern city in the Gaza Strip that's packed with over 1 million Palestinian civilians. So this statement came following talks between U.S. and Israeli officials that covered Iran's reprisal attack on Israel and Israeli plans to invade Rafah. The U.S. has expressed concerns about the potential assault because it will cause mass civilian casualties, but the U.S. ultimately appears to support the idea of Israel attacking the city based on this statement. And these talks were between Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, and the Israeli Minister for Strategic Affairs, Ron Dermer, who's a former U.S. ambassador to the U.S., and Tzatzi Hanegbi, who is Israel's national security advisor. So the White House said in a statement, quote, "The two sides agreed on the shared objective to see Hamas defeated in Rafah. U.S. participants expressed concerns with various courses of action in Rafah, and Israeli participants agreed to take these concerns into account and to have further follow-up discussions," end quote. So these same officials met back on April 1st to discuss Rafah, and the White House put out a nearly identical press release. So it doesn't seem like there's really any progress being made here. The U.S. is claiming that it's concerned, but it doesn't look like it's putting any real pressure on Israel. As we saw that report that Israel apparently planned to do this Rafah invasion. They were going to start by dropping leaflets on the city on Monday, but, you know, which goes to show that they don't have any real plan for the civilians that are there, any real evacuation plan, if they're just going to drop leaflets and then go ahead with the invasion. So there was also a report from the New Arab that says Israel gave, the U.S. gave Israel the green light to invade Rafah in exchange for Israel not escalating against Iran. But I saw someone say on Twitter that this, you know, that that report aged poorly now that Israel is attacking Iran. So, but we'll see. And I just put the updated numbers in here. So the latest numbers from Gaza's health ministry put the death toll at 33,970, and that does not take into account the thousands of Palestinians who are missing and presumed dead under the rubble. All right, so the next one here, Ben-Gvir, the Israeli Minister of National Security, says kill Palestinians to make more room in prisons. So Ben-Gvir has called for the execution of Palestinians to make room in Israel's overcrowded prisons. Ben-Gvir, who's the leader of the Jewish Power Party, said that he was happy that the Israeli government approved a construction plan to expand prisons, but said that the best solution would be the death penalty. He wrote on X, quote, "The additional construction will allow the prison service to take in more terrorists and will bring a partial solution to the prison crisis that exists in the Shabak. The death penalty for terrorists is the right solution to the incarceration problem. Until then, I'm glad that the government approved this proposal," end quote. So he's talking about the construction, but he's saying we got to start killing these people. And so, again, Ben-Gvir is the Israeli National Security Minister. And in that position, you know, this isn't just some random fringe Israeli politician with no influence. In his position, he oversees the Israeli prison service, the Israeli prison system. He oversees the Israeli police and the border police. So that's who's saying this, is the minister in charge of this stuff. And he has been pushing for a bill that would mandate the death penalty for Palestinians found guilty of terrorism in Israeli courts. And I just put in another thing that he said recently was that Israeli forces should shoot Palestinian women and children if they get too close to the border. In fact, he said that they must get a bullet in their head. Again, talking about Palestinian women and children. So this is the kind of guy that he is and is in a very influential position in this government. All right, so the next one here, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene puts forward an amendment that says representatives who back Ukraine aid should go fight. So this article is from Kyle Anzalone at the Libertarian Institute. So Greene has proposed an amendment requiring lawmakers who vote in favor of the $60 billion Ukrainian aid bill to join the country's military. And she's also, along with Thomas Massie, saying that they're going to try to oust Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, over this bill that he has put forward, these multiple foreign military aid bills that add up to $95 billion, exactly what Biden wanted. So the Green is, you know, putting this amendment forward. It doesn't have any chance of passing, but it's definitely, you know, kind of funny and interesting. And I think by her logic, if I'm correct, that she's probably going to vote for the Israel aid. By this logic, I guess she's got to go sign up for the IDF. She wrote on X, quote, "If you want to fund the endless foreign wars, you should have to go fight them. That's why I'm introducing an amendment that would require any member of Congress who votes for the multi-billion dollar Ukraine supplemental to enlist in Ukraine's military," end quote. She also introduced amendments that would direct funding from Ukraine to space lasers to defend the southwest border or aid to Americans impacted by a major train derailment in Ohio and wildfires in Hawaii. And she's introducing these amendments kind of to stick it to Johnson. That's the idea here. So we'll see what happens. You know, there was a lot of talk today about the potential of Johnson being ousted, of them invoking this motion to vacate the speakership. We'll see what happens with that. I think the Democrats are going to bail him out because he gave them everything that they wanted. All right, so the next one here, the U.S. reimposes oil sanctions on Venezuela. So the U.S. reimposed sanctions on Venezuela on Thursday by not renewing a license that eased restrictions on the South American nation's oil industry. The U.S. issued a six-month license in October after the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro made a deal with the U.S.-backed opposition on the upcoming presidential election. The U.S. is claiming that Maduro has not fully met the commitments to the deal and accused the Palestinian leader of preventing democratic opposition from registering the candidate of their choice. The U.S. previously reimposed other sanctions after Venezuela's Supreme Court disqualified two opposition figures from running for president. So you talk about election interference and meddling. You know, they have this economic embargo on a country and are trying to dictate the terms to lift it. The State Department said that a new 45-day license has been granted to give companies a wind-down period to stop doing business with Venezuelan companies. Just a little background on the situation in Venezuela. It was in 2019 that the U.S. basically launched a failed regime change effort against Maduro by backing Juan Guaido, this opposition figure who was not particularly popular, but he declared himself the interim president. He had the backing of the U.S. and the EU. The U.S. really put all these sanctions on Venezuela. They already had some sanctions on them, but really tightened them. And again, essentially what amounts to an economic embargo. Guaido launched a coup that failed pretty miserably. And last year, the opposition removed him as the interim president and dissolved the so-called interim government. I believe they still have access to, you know, Venezuela's offshore funds that the U.S. just gives them this like so-called interim government. I guess they're not called that anymore, but they had access to Venezuela's offshore money. All right, so the next one here, U.S. Navy flies a plane through the Taiwan Strait. So a U.S. Navy P-8A Poseidon reconnaissance plane flew through the Taiwan Strait on Wednesday, a day after Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin held rare talks with his Chinese counterpart. So the conversation between Austin and Dong, the Chinese defense minister, marked the first time the two nations' defense chiefs have held talks since 2022, as relations have been very bad between the U.S. and China. So they have these talks, and during the call, Austin said the U.S. is going to continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows. And that means he's saying we're going to continue to operate in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait. And here we have the U.S. flying a reconnaissance plane, a spy plane, through the Taiwan Strait right after these talks. And it's sending a message because this doesn't happen very often. The U.S. more frequently sends warships through the Taiwan Strait. The plane overflights are less common. The last time this was announced by the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet, which is based in Japan, the last time that they announced that a plane flew through the Taiwan Strait was back in December. And the last time they said that a U.S. Navy destroyer sailed through the Taiwan Strait, that was in March. So these things, the planes don't happen as often, but still China said that they scrambled fighter jets and that they were on high alert over the presence of this U.S. plane. All right, so that is it for the news. I left up the one about Niger from yesterday. That's because it's just a very interesting, important story. But go check out our viewpoints. One from Ramzi Baroud: leaked New York Times memo reveals anti-Palestinian bias of U.S. media. One from John and Nisha Whitehead: warrantless surveillance makes a mockery of the Constitution. One from Gideon Levy: no victory awaits Israel in Rafah, only more death and destruction. One from William J. Astore: there is only one spaceship Earth. Go check out our spotlight by Feroz Sidhwa and Mark Perimutter. I totally butchered his name. I apologize for that. As surgeons, we have never seen cruelty like Israel in Gaza. So these are surgeons who were just in Gaza. And these are the people, you know, since international media is not being allowed in, it's the doctors and surgeons who volunteer and then report back. They're essentially the reporters. And the things that they're saying, the accounts from Gaza hospitals, just absolutely horrific. Sounds like hell on earth. So please go read that. But that's it for me. Again, there's probably going to be a lot happening after this show is posted. but just trying to keep you up to speed with everything that's happening. Anyway, sometimes it's good to wait a few, you know, wait a little while till everything's sorted out. You know, when these things happen, you just see so much unconfirmed stuff spread around and rumors that it's tough to know what's what right away. But anyway, I hope everyone has a good weekend. Hopefully things don't get out of control here. I mean, this could be really, really, really bad. So we'll see what happens. But I will be back Sunday night recording for Monday's show. I will talk to you then. Thanks for listening.